Let's open up the beginning of the parasha. Okay, Perek Yud Pasuk Aleph, the beginning of Parshat Bo. V'yomer Hashem el Moshe, Bo el Paro, ki mi hichbadati et libo, v'leib avadav l'man shiti atotai, eila bikir bo. A lot of commentaries, and I'm sure Divrei Torah this week, which will be said, will revolve around the use of the word bo, where over here, Moshe is told by God, Bo el Paro, come to Paro. And that's a very strange thing, because of course it should have said Lech el Paro. And from the very beginning, when Moshe sent on his mission, then the term which is in fact used is that Moshe is told to go. So the question is a very simple question: why is the word Bo used and not any other word? Why come to Paro? When that, as I said, seems strange. Rashi's comment is somewhat cryptic. Rashi says, "Vayomishem Moshe bo paro, v'hitrabo." Hitrabo means to give him tofa, to warn him, yom hatra'ah, to warn him. Now there are a number of things which are strange over here. Because here, Rashi has to tell us that God said to Moshe to give him hatra'ah, where, if you compare this with other makot, where God says to Moshe, warn Paro, so why is that absent over here? That's one question that comes up. Another question that comes up is the continuation in the second pasuk, Uleman tisaper ba'osnei bincha uven bincha, et asher hitalalti b'mitzrayim ve'et ototai asher samti bam v'yadatim kini Hashem. What's missing over here? God says, come to Paro, and I will harden his heart. Now, a lot of commentaries go into that issue. What does this mean about hardening the heart? Then he says, in order for me to do these miracles, and in order to tell you in the ears of your children, your children's children, that which I have abused Egypt and the wonders which I have put there, and then you'll know that I'm God. What's missing? It's missing because he doesn't say which makah. He doesn't say what makah is coming. Then Vayavo Moshe Aaron el Paro Vayomer Lav Kol Ma Hashem Elokei Avriim Ad Matay Ma'anta Lano Miponai Shelacha Mi Vavyud Ki Ma'ena Tala Shelecha Tamei Hine Mevi Machar Arbe VeGvulecha. That if you don't listen, then tomorrow you get Arbe. But over here, again, the problem is obvious. It was never mentioned Arbe. So over here, you have a whole bunch of questions or problems which coincide. You have the Bo el Paro. You have the side problem which we won't speak about in terms of hardening the heart. You have the problem of God not telling which makah is coming. And then finally, Moshe knows exactly what it is he's supposed to say. Yeah. That's not this makah. Your notes are correct. And I did say that, but that is correct, and that is this week's parasha, but that has to do with Makat B'Chorot. That's Makat B'Chorot. That's the first one which Moshe is told about. All the way back in chapter 4, God says to Moshe, tell Paro that if you do this to my firstborn, I am going to go and kill your firstborn. And Israel is my firstborn. So then when it comes time for Makat B'Chorot, and God says, I have one more makah, so Moshe already knows what it is, I have to tell him what it is. So over there, it's easier, because over there already back in Perek Dalet, we were told about it. Over here, there was no previous information to tell us, oh, that means that Arba is coming. So look, the art commentaries, the Ketiva Kabbalah say, okay, the Torah does not always give you verbatim what the conversation is. And it's as if God said to Moshe, dot, 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 you know, you've already gone through this enough times that you know you guys know how this goes already. And therefore, there is information which is clearly missing. So that is one approach was taken, and therefore the questions fall away. God did tell, and so on. But that doesn't help us necessarily with the Bo El Paro. Now, if any of you were paying attention, even the least bit last week, I don't mean my class, where I wasted your time talking about frogs, and therefore you had nothing to talk about on Friday night. But what I'm talking about instead is, if you paid attention to the Kriyat Torah last week, if you had the Kriyat Torah last week, you perhaps would have noticed that this is not the first time that the term Bo is used. Matter of fact, this is the third time that the term, at least the third time, that the term Bo is used within the discussion of the Makot. So it's not so simple that right over here that there's something unique and that there's something different. All the little kids in school will learn about the Baal HaTurim that says that Bo adds up to three, because there's three Makot in this week's Parsha, and Va'era, Vav and Aleph add up to seven, because there were seven Makot in last week's Parsha. And that's how you always remember the division. Right? All the kids will come home from the school saying this, and that's how they remember. And you know what? That's a very good mnemonic device. And therefore, you can now always remember that you had seven over there, and you have three over here. Speaking of mnemonic devices, all of us also should be familiar with Rabbi Yehuda's mnemonic device, which he taught us in the Haggadah, where it says, "Elu Esther Makot Shehvi HaKadosh Baruch Hu Al HaMitzrim B'Mitzrayim Ve'elu Hein Dam Tzadeh Kinim Orev Gever Shchin Barad Arbe Choshech Makat Bechorot Rabbi Yehuda Hayanotein Bem Simanim Tatzach Adash Bachav." So you get to spill out a little bit more wine. The problem putting your hand in the wine, put your hand in the wine, you have to pour more wine, because the coast becomes a coast bogum. But what does Rabbi Yehuda want from us? So on one level, I can simply say that what Rabbi Yehuda is doing is something which we find all over the Gemara, and he's giving us a mnemonic device. This is a way to remember the Makot. Come on, I'm sure a lot of you have studied for finals at some point in your lives, and you made, right? No, you've never studied. When you memorize a great deal of, you memorize a great deal of material. So then you use some kinds of a memory aid or tool in order to recall the information. So on one level, that's all that Rabbi Yehuda is doing. On another level, however, it could be that what Rabbi Yehuda is telling us, and this is the way that a great deal of Rishonim understand it, that what Rabbi Yehuda is actually doing is analyzing for us the Makot and showing us form and structure that perhaps we would not have noticed otherwise. Because as far as Rabbi Yehuda is concerned, the division of the Makot into three sets of three, or perhaps it's three sets of three and then one standing on its own, is something which is intrinsic to the understanding of the Makot, and therefore would give us much greater insight when we get to any individual Makot. For example, would anybody off the top of their head, without knowing, want to guess where the other times Bo is used? You don't know this, but I'm just telling you to guess right now, because I've already given you enough information to guess. Anybody know when Bo is used in the other times? You don't know, right? You want to guess? What?
First of each of the mnemonic terms.
Is it the first? Your math isn't that great. 1 second. It should be the second, the?
Fifth.
It should be the second, the?
Fifth.
Maybe my math. It should be the second. So let's try this out. Which means in our mind, maybe even like write it down for yourself so that this actually did make a list for you. No, make a list of all 10 Makot, and then we'll put them into threes. Dam, Sfardeya, Kinim. That's Datsach. That's your first three. Dam, Sfardeya, Kinim. Then you have Arov, Dever, Shvin. Then you have Barad, Arbe, Koshech. And at the end, you have Makat Bechorot. What are we up to now? We're up to Arbe. Arbe within your triplet is the second, correct? Which means when would you guess that Bo would come for your other times? It should come by Tzfardeya, and it should come by Dever. So you want to try it out? You want to now look in the Chumash and see if this works? This would be so much easier if you had these sheets, wouldn't it? Turn to Perek Zion, Pasuk Kavav. Vayomar Hashem el Moshe, bo el paro v'amarta elav ko amar Hashem shalachet ami v'avduni. So what do you notice right away? Bo el paro. And then, v'imma'en ata l'shaleach, hinei anokhi nogef et kol gvulecha b'tzvardein. So, first of all, you note that by tzvardea, it does say the term bo. Just in case you're wondering what it said by dam, right? By dam, it's lech el parah. So by dam, you had lech el parah. But there's also another thing about dam. So let's try to get... Let's do one thing at a time, and then we'll go back to dam. Where's the other time that we suspect we should find bo? During the Perek Tet, Pasuk Aleph. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, bo paro v'dibarte elav, ko amar Hashem Elokei Avrim, shalachet amiv avduni, ki ma'ena tala shalayach, otcha machzik vam, hinei yad Hashem, hoya v'mikincha, asher b'sadeh, b'sussim v'chamarim, b'gmalim v'vakor v'tzon, dezer kaved ma'od. I can now assure you, if you look at the other makot, you won't find bo, other than these three. So already we should begin to get to the suspicion that when Rabbi Yehuda is telling us to divide the makot into triplets, into three different sets of three, and again, there is one more at the end, that maybe it's not just a mnemonic device, or maybe it's trying to tell us something which is intrinsically related to the makot.
Dam is
for day. It's always the second one that says bow.
Oh.
Because this week's parsha starts with the seven. That's the problem. That's the problem.
Yeah. I also have a question. If Moses and Aaron turn the water to blood, how can the magicians also turn the water to blood?
Don't ask me such questions. Watch the movie. Watch it carefully. Watch it carefully in slow motion. Maybe David Blaine will do it this week. Unless the magicians in Egypt actually were in touch with some kind of black magic. Although we spoke about this last week. It's very amusing to me that God sends Moshe and Aaron to do Tzardeya, so they do Tzardeya, so then they'll say, okay, we'll do more. We'll do Kinim, okay, now we'll do more Kinim. Great, so what are they left with now? They're left with more Kinim. I mean, I'm just amused by this.
Yeah, but they're showing Pharaoh that they have the capability.
Good, but what's the result? The result of Paro's magicians being able to do this is that they're going to suffer more. Okay, and that's on many levels, because the result of Paro doing these things is not only going to suffer more, because now Paro's heart is going to be hard, because, oh look, we can do this also. It's not only that you can abuse me, I can abuse myself. So like, what do I need you for? No, I'm saying, so I'm amused when I'm, you're not amused?
Yeah.
Good.
But in a sense, it shows that they have the same power.
I'm saying, okay, look.
But they're harming themselves now.
Exactly.
Look. They really don't, because they can't stop it.
If
interesting things, can they turn it
off? One thing I will point out, it's very, very clear that as far as negotiations go, we did not do a very good job in these negotiations. Right? This is the beginning of many, many... we'll stop. No, it's terrible. It's just terrible. Because you have them, and Paro goes, no, stop, it's too much. He goes, okay. Next, we have them again, it's too much. Stop, okay. Which is, if you really want to apply the pressure, so what do?
You don't stop.
But, you got them.
Get out the door.
Yeah. So it's very clear that there is a larger objective over here. And that we're told about over here. The larger objective is that you should see my wonders and you should tell your children and this should go on for generation to generation. Which means that there are other issues going on over here. The fact that Paro's magicians can do the same thing is obviously part of a larger plan. Okay, let's have a full stop there.
Maybe they think it would put red dye upstream.
You're talking about Moshe, or are you talking about?
So why go a second in Egypt?
So you're still on the bow now. Okay, so Rabbi Yehuda apparently notices something. Rabbi Yehuda notices, again, and we're jumping into this in the middle, because we're up to number 7, so because we're up to number 7, we're speaking about specific, we're speaking at number 2, we're speaking about number... We're speaking about... We're speaking of 2, 5... Okay, 2, 5, and 8. There's also going to be things in common with 1, 4, and 7. And there will be things in common with whatever's left, with 3, 6, and 9. Which means, when Rabbi Yehuda is telling us that there is that Sach Adash Bachav, you could look at that going this way, or you can look at this lining up the other way, which is, he seems to be lining them up in sets of 3, in order that, meaning that Sach is on one line, Adash is on the next line, and Bachav is on the next line, in order for you then to be able to make a chart, and to go down, and not just to go across. Was that clear enough?
Yeah.
Anyone want to do this on the board?
Yeah.
Good.
Yes.
Go ahead. I'm to the board. So let's think for a second. The ones that are in common Dam, Arov, and Barad. Makat Bechor stands by itself.
Why does it not stand by itself?
It's, according to some of the Rishonim, it stands by itself. According to some, it starts all over again. It's a fourth set, but it's by itself. Dam, Arov, and Barad. Dam is blood. Arov is a wild animal, stampede. And Barad is hail with fire. Svadeya, Dever, Arbeh. Those 3 go together. Those are 3 that we're talking about that all talk about bow. The ones Dam, Arov, and Barad, what do they all have in common? Apparently, and this is clear by the first 2 of them, what do Dam and Arov have in common? Dam, he does not say bow el paro. Rather, he says, to do what? To go where? Lech where?
Down to the river.
To go down to the river. Okay? To go down to the river. Why to go down to the river? Well, that's where you do dam. You do dam down by the river. But at least the first one is lech. Where is it? Which means lech is going to be to the river. Bo is going to be to the palace. Let's just see that inside just to try that out. Where is dam? Parak Zion, Pasuk Tevav, Lech El Paro Baboker, Hinei Yotzei Hamayma. So it's Lech to Paro, and he's going out to the water. Let's now skip a little bit and get to Arov. Tet what? Tet Yud Zayin. Tet Yud Zayin. Pasuk Tet Zayin is better. Tet Zayin. Vayomer Hashem El Moshe. Hashkein Babok. Yetzei Bofnei Paro. Hinei Yotzei Hamayma. Okay, so again you see that the first and the fourth have something in common. Again, if you're looking for patterns, the pattern at this point should be clear, that the first and the fourth, neither of those said bo, rather those said lech, but both of them had something in common about lech. It's lech.
Where does it say?
Sorry, hit yetzev. Sorry. Here it's no, sorry. Here it's not, right, here it's not bo, sorry. Vayom Hashem paro hashkem b'vokav hit yetzev lefnei paro. Here is not bo, come to paro, rather over here it's go, hit yetzev lefnei paro, hinei yotzei hamayim. Again, the thing which links this together with the previous one, this dam, is the river. Both of these take place by the river. Next one will be? No. The next one we're looking for is the next first one, which is Farad. So where's the pasuk? Right. So now read Tet Yud Gimel, and you'll realize it doesn't say one thing that we would have wanted it to say, but I think the pattern still says. What does it say actually? Yomer Shemoshe Hashkem Baboker. Where's the last time that we had Hashkem? We had Baboker, right? Baboker. Hit Yatzev of Ne Paro, and also last time was Hit Yatzev. The one thing which is missing over here is the clear statement of water. But again, this is what, again, various Rishonim will now notice, and they'll say that the Hit Yatzev is consistent, and therefore, in our group, which we're calling Datsach, in all of these you have not to come to the palace, rather to go out to the water. And the question will be, why? Some of us remember, again, we have these, you know, these various Midrashim in our minds, that Paro was going out to the river in order to bathe, in order to use the bathroom, and no one knew that Paro used the bathroom, which itself is a very strange thing. No one ever followed Paro to the bathroom. Nobody ever followed Paro to the river, and so some take this approach and therefore say Moshe knew that Paro secretly went to the bathroom, and therefore he got Paro in this time of somewhat embarrassment, and therefore he had some leverage on Paro. But I want to ask you something. Does it make more sense to suggest that? Or does it make more sense to say that when Paro goes down to the river, it will be more of a public display? Which means, where is going to be a more private display? In the palace or by the river? And again, the way that a lot of us were brought up, that in the river, that's like the secretive thing by the mirror, but in the palace, then the movie helps us as well, that in the palace is in front of everybody and all these groups are coming in. And now, I do want you to think about this a second, is what I just now said, which is our mind. And again, the movie helps us with these scenes. Is this necessarily going to be the case? Or could I argue it's going to be the complete opposite? That when it's talking about going down to the river, that's a public display. Again, the river is something for Paro, which is the core of his power. It's what he connects to as far as the source of his power. The Nile River overflows. That is what sustains Egypt in the Egyptian mythology, at least the way it's understood by Chazal, and certainly this is based on the pasuk that we read last week in the Navi, in the Haftorah, that Paro claims to have created the Nile, Paro claims to be the life force behind the life force of Egypt. So therefore, when Paro would go down to the river, would it make more sense that it was a private thing, or that it would be more of a display? And does it make more sense when Paro goes into the palace, when Moshe comes into the palace, is that going to be something which is going to be a very big public display? Or is that perhaps going to be something which is going to be far more intimate? Yeah.
You say that Paro went down to the river because no one saw him going to the bathroom.
Right.
He would obviously go at a time where no one was at the river.
Right. Which is early in the morning, every morning.
Therefore, no one would do that, and that would be the case.
I understand that. But over here, so Moshe is the only one who's onto it, and therefore Moshe is the only one by, again, three makot, not in a row, first, fourth, and seventh, where Moshe goes and follows him down to the river, and every time poor Paro, every time he's about to go to the bathroom, Moshe's standing there bothering him and starting another makan. Excuse me? Correct. And as I said, because it uses the word hityatzev, and because it talks about the boat, the morning, therefore it's understood. Therefore, it's understood that these are connected. Again, we're following Rabbi Yehuda's approach that dam, excuse me, that tzach, not tzach, it's dam, arov, and barad are related, right? Going down in the first, the fourth, and the seventh, that these are related. So then you read those three psukim or those three descriptions together. That's what Rabbi Yehuda is asking us to do. And when you do that, then you notice its own independent pattern. Again, when I look at the second, when I look at Tzfardeya, Dever, and Arbeh, then I notice that all of those possess one thing in common. What's that? That's the bow. When I look at the other group together, I now notice that there's something else is common. Let's get to the last point. Is there anything in common regarding the three that we haven't mentioned yet? Kinim, Shchin, and Choshech. Is there anything in common with those? Are you all confused at this point? Kinim, Shchin, and Choshech. Is there anything in common with those? So let's look at the larger structure now. Because after all this, I really hope that everything will become much clearer. There's no warning by these three. Which means there's no warning. By the way, in the first of each group, there is a warning. And where does the warning take place? Apparently by the water. The second group, the second one of each group, there's a warning, and where does it take place? In the palace. The third of each group, there's no longer a warning. To which Chazal say, a person's warned one time, a person's warned the second time, and the third time, you don't warn them anymore.
Then you say the third set of Makot, the ones that want to be warned, not every third.
So that's what Rabbi Yehuda is teaching us, is that there are three sets, that each one is an independent set. And therefore, not to look at it as the first three are together, the second three are together. It's like the first one of each set has a plan behind it, the second one has a plan, the third one has a plan, and they're not the same thing. By the way, the first one of each of the sets, Aaron does. The second one of each of the sets, Moshe does. The third of each of the sets, apparently, God does. Which means that when I start dividing following Rabbi Yehuda's instructions, things really become much, much clearer in terms of exactly how they are divided. Rav Hirsch, Aaron. Rav Hirsch, who, and it's worth reading it if you have it at home, Rav Hirsch divides them up, and he claims that the objective of each one of these sets are different objectives. Which means he's going to ask, what exactly do Dam, Arov, and Barad have in common? He's going to ask, what did Tzfardeya, Dever, and Arbeh have in common? And then he'll ask, what do Kinim, Shchin, and Choshech have in common? Which means as far as Makot go, he thinks that, again, you have three different sets, but they're trying to accomplish different things. So therefore, the first one in each group has one particular goal, the second in each group has a second goal, and the third in each group has a yet another goal. His, and I'm saying this in one line, he says this in far more than one line, he thinks that the first ones of each are to make the Egyptians feel uncomfortable, but the main word that he uses is the word of strangers. He wants them to feel like strangers in their own land. Where exactly does he get this, and how does he work it out? That's why it's worth reading exactly how he describes it. But Dam affects the Nile. The Nile is this everyday, again, staple of the Egyptian life. The Nile is where they get their stability from. The Nile is what makes them feel at home. The Nile is what gives them their confidence. When the Nile is struck, they will feel very disoriented. When the Nile is struck, they'll feel as if they're not at home. They'll say there's something wrong. It's not just your water being shut off. It's much more than the water being shut off. It's their whole life now is going to be turned upside down by having the Nile struck. And he says that the focus of this is to feel like what it's like to be a stranger in someone in a different land. The Jews are made to feel as if they're strange, as if they're different, as if they're not really home. This is not where they belong. Therefore, the first thing by the water is for them to be struck in this particular way. He continues and claims the same thing is true in terms of the animals of the arov.
Water, land, and sky.
There are the
water,
I was,
land, and air.
Right. There are those who use that within their corrected in their divisions as well. Yeah.
And how can Torah and the Nile be God, and why would Torah go to the toilet and the Nile be God?
You need to have a better understanding of how pagans look at their deities. It's not a Jewish understanding of God, so therefore it's a pagan understanding of God, and therefore the question really isn't a question from the pagan perspective. As far as the set of Tzfardea, Dever, and Arbea, what do those have in common? Tzfardea, Dever, and Arbea, what do they have in common? So it's interesting. It's interesting. These are the ones that we started with in terms of Bo, which he's told about in the home. Where do we see that Tzfardea ends up? It ends up in his house, in his bed. The way that Rav Hirsch puts it is that the term he uses is actually one of the emptiness of pride which owning a slave causes. He wants the Egyptians to feel not at home in their own home, which means when you own a slave, you own somebody who does things for you, and you have a great deal of pride of having somebody else doing your work for you. He wants to say that the owner of the slave feels empowered. What he wants to do in these makot is take away that empowerment. How do you take away that empowerment? So while the first one was going out of the home, going out down to the Nile, and that is feeling somewhat lost, disoriented on a general term, when your own bedroom is crawling with frogs, that's something which is, you can own a slave, but you have completely lost your sense of power. Before I try to explain this by the others, the Dever and the Arbet, again, he'll make the same argument, but I want you to think a second about the last group. What is the purpose of the last group? And this will, once you ask this question, I think the answer will be very, very simple and forthcoming. Kinim, Shchin, and Choshech. What do they have in common? What? Kinim, Shchin, and Choshech. They affect the person. Kinim is lice, right? Shchin is boils, and Choshech is darkness. Which means while the others could be affecting, you know, the general atmosphere, or could be affecting the home or the fields, at this point you're affecting the person themselves. As far as Rav Hirsch is concerned, again, he is not the first person to suggest this, that the third group is the punishment for not listening to the first and the second. Right? That we already said that in a sense. The Gemara, you know, Gemara says in general terms, as I said, Mishon already said, but the third group is for inui, is for punishment. But now it becomes interesting that you note that the punishment of the first of this group is far more profound on a personal level than the punishments on the other. Which means, when you have lice, it's not that your water is undrinkable; it's that you have lice, you have personal discomfort. When you have boils, right? So it's interesting, now you understand why Chazal stressed that the third one in that group is darkness. It's that each one felt the darkness. Each one felt this overwhelming fear of the dark. And it wasn't the kind of darkness that, it just happens not to have the light on. It was one which affected each and every person on an individual level. So therefore, as far as, again, using Rabbi Yehuda's explanation, the third one of each of each of the groups is there as a punishment. It's there on a personal level as a punishment. It's there as to suffer, but it's because of the first two. When it comes to the idea, and let's go back to Bo now, because again, part of what we really haven't answered yet, which we've made an observation. We haven't explained it. We've made an observation. What's the observation? That some of the makot take place, the warning takes place out in the morning by the water. Some of the warnings take place inside the palace. When it's to go, it's really hityatsev. But when it's to come to the palace, then the word bow is always used. And that's the bow which we started with today. Why the different terms? Again, if I want to now try to work it out with the different types of punishments, it could be that some of the things do affect the home more, and therefore it's going to be the bow. Certain things perhaps are going to be more of a general term outside, and therefore it's done outside. The Ramban makes an observation about the water which is completely different than we would have thought, and that's what I started to say before. The Ramban. V'amar, v'miktzat ha-makot, this is the Ramban, Perichet, Pasuk Tetva. V'miktzat ha-makot, by some of the makot, it says, Hashkem ba-boker, hine yotze ha-mayma. Get up in the morning, go to the water. Now, again, that will end up, various elements of Hashkem, Baboker, Hamayim will cover, as we now know, the first one in each set. Now that's when he goes for his morning swim and for his morning and so on. Which means the Ramban does not necessarily identify with those Mefarshim who claim that, or it's even the Midrashim that claim that Paro was going all by himself. It sounds as if in the Ramban that it is a bit more of a public display. Just give me one second. The Balei Tosfot, on the other hand, they'll make note that when it says bo, what's the connotation of bo? Yeah, let's get to the most basic one. If it says bow, it means come. What's the connotation then? Or what's the implication? If it says bow, where is God? Right, that God is coming with him. If God is telling Moshe to go, so then what's the implication? That Moshe is going alone. So why would God say to Moshe, come when it's those three which are in the palace, when it goes down to the Nile, you go? So now, the various Mefreshim are going to identify with what we already know. Some will say because the Nile is a place of Avodah Zarah, it's not right for the Shekhinah to go there as well. Some will say if Paro is going to the bathroom and taking that whole approach, it's not right for, it's not appropriate for God, for the Shekhinah to be manifest over there either. On the other hand, in the palace, that's going to be seen somewhat differently. Yeah. Excuse
me?
That's why I said go back and read Rav Hirsch, because he goes and tries to make all the things fit. No, I'm saying whether you find it convincing at the end, the structure is very nice and read it, because he makes each thing work in. Okay. As far as, you know, specifically the bow that we're up to this week, that we're up to the Arabeh, we're up to locusts. Again, one of the problems that we had from the very beginning is that it never warned him, it never told him which one it was. So you do have midrashim, and again, I'm just trying to think how to do this today where you don't have the sources. I want to try to limit from doing things that you can't access properly. But there are midrashim who work it out together with the pasuk in Sefer Yoel. If you ever read the very beginning of Sefer Yoel, and that's in Treyasar, it's the beginning of Treyasar, and it says, Dvar Hashem Shaya El Yoel Ben Petuel, Shem Uzo Tazakinim, Vazinu Kol Yoshvei Aretz, Haita Zot B'Yemechem, Ve'im Yemei Avotechem, Alel L'Vnechem Sapru, V'Nechem L'Vneim, V'Vneim L'Dor Acher, Yeter HaGazam Achal Ha'arbe, V'Yeter Marbe Achal Ha'Yelek, V'Yeter Ha'Yelek Achal Ha'Chasiyon. I'll read in English. The word of the Lord that came to Yoel, the son of Petuel, hear this, you old men, and give ear all your inhabitants of the land. Has such a thing been in your days, or even in the days of your fathers? Tell your children of it, and let your children tell their children another generation, that which the cutting locust has left, the swarming locust has eaten, which the swarming locust have left, the hopping locust have eaten, and that which the hopping locust have left, the destroying locust have eaten. Those of us who are unfamiliar with different types of locusts, there are many, many types of locusts. But it's interesting because here specifically it's, what's the matter?
We're familiar.
Over here it speaks about many types of locusts, and it also says tell the future generations.
Sorry, I'm a little bit confused. I thought you said that there was a warning for locusts, and now you just said that there was no warning for locusts.
So, what I said was as follows. God doesn't tell Moshe what to say, yet Moshe knows to warn Paro. So there is warning. Paro is warned, but God didn't tell him what to say, which was the problem that we had from the very beginning. So if you look in source 2, you can't look in source 2. If you look back in Perek Yud, the pasuk we started with, Vayomar Shem Moshe bo el Paro kini chbadati et libo v'leiv avadav l'man shitiyat otai eila bikirbo. So it's very interesting. Here it doesn't say what it is, but yet Moshe knows, so therefore there is warning. But what does it say? It says to tell the future generations about it. So then you'll have Mefarshim, like the Ramban, but it's all based upon Medrash, Medrash Rabbah, that something to the effect that Moshe really knew the Pasuk in Yoel, and therefore this is the kind of thing that you tell future generations about, and therefore obviously it had to be locusts. Now, whether you like that logic or not, as I told you, the other version saying, it's sort of like dot, dot, dot. We've done enough of these makot already that we already know the larger system, so therefore it becomes clear. There is another, though, issue that I want to focus on back in that passage. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, of course, is Midat HaRachamim. Midat HaRachamim comes and says, I've hardened Paro's heart, and I'm going to give him all of these punishments. So, how exactly does the Midat HaRachamim work together with all of the pain and suffering that take place to the Egyptians? Even though I can say that pain for a tormentor is Rachamim on the part of God. Right? I could say that.
How is that Midat HaRachamim?
I want to read you two different comments by the Orachaim. First, the Orachaim on this pasuk right over here. Perek Yud pasuk Aleph. Vayomer Shel Moshe, Amar Loshen Amira Racha. The word Amira, to speak, is a soft type of speaking. Daber is stronger, Amar is softer. Gam Iskir Shem HaRachamim. You know, you're getting all warm and fuzzy. Vayomer Hashem, right? And more speak, and it's very nice and soft. I will share with you in a moment what Rabbi Soloveitchik does with this, but the Orach Chaim doesn't like it. So he writes, Lo v'tzad ha-mishtaleach elav, el v'tzad ha-shaliach, shuskor b'samokho Moshe. God is not speaking nicely over here because that's the message that will be conveyed to Paro. Rather, God is speaking nicely. Why? Because he's speaking to Moshe. He's speaking to Moshe. And then he goes on at the end, he says, but certainly would be appropriate to use Midat HaRachamim ki afilu midat harachmim hiskima b'simcha la'asot din lihinakem oyev zeh. That of course the midat harachmim would agree to take vengeance on this wicked individual. Which means you do have a little bit of a theological issue, which I said is not an impossible issue. Theological issue would be, when it comes to punishing our enemies, is that midat hadin that punishes our enemies, or is that midat rachim that punishes our enemies? Is it God taking vengeance, or is it God acting with compassion? Because of course compassion to us is strictness for them. So the Aruch Chaim notices the software that God is speaking over here to Moshe, and he notices that there is midat harachim being used, and he says, therefore, it's not directed towards Paro, it's the opposite is true, it's directed towards Moshe. On the other hand, or to continue this line of thought, the Aruch Chaim had already told us in Perek Tet Pasuk Aleph, which is where it used bo in the previous occurrence, bo el paro, klal ze biyadcha. He goes, focus, notice this. Kol makom shiyomar bo el paro, yichuvan lomar lo, shikanes el traklin shelo, velo hashalat rishut. Just walk right in. Moshe, don't ask permission, don't ring the bell, don't knock on the door. Just walk right in. Hagam shirilo mishpat hamalachim shomrei habayit, afapichin, ya'ul v'yikanes etzlami b'lisha let reshut. Even though Paro must have had guards, here he's saying that it must be that Moshe walked in without asking any permission whatsoever. The kachia oseka omram, ki kama shomrim hayu l'paro mizuyanim v'arayot v'klavim v'nechnas v'im monea. He goes, and the rabbis point out, it must be that he had all of these things protecting him. How does Moshe just go in? But I mean, this is a very serious question. Somebody asked me this last week. How could it be that Moshe goes in time after time after time, and Paro doesn't do anything to him? Well, next time I'm not going to let you in. I'm not going to see you anymore. Why does he kill him on the spot? You're talking about Paro over here. Paro's not this nice guy. He doesn't care about public opinion. He doesn't care about anything. How in the world does Moshe get in time after time? Meaning, he's going out to the core of what Bo El Paro means, and he suggests that Moshe is able to go in, and as far as he's concerned, he has a proof of this. Matzati raya burala devrayim, imash amar paro lemoshe, shemer lacha, al tasif rod panecha, be careful, I won't see you anymore. Why isn't Paro just killing him? So he says, it must be, he goes, elavada ki lo amdu kinegdo afilo ariyeh zenes atzum. He sees within this whole narrative an unbelievable miracle that nobody can touch Moshe. They can try to kill him, they can do anything, nobody can touch Moshe. So what the Aruch Chaim senses over here within this description of Bo, he's saying he is ignoring one thing. He's ignoring that Bo sounds to us as if the Shekhinah is inviting him as well. And what he's saying, it must be that he goes in, and any kind of softness in language here is directed towards Moshe, but as far as Paro is concerned, what are we talking about? We're talking about strictness, we're talking about vengeance, and we're talking about Paro getting his punishment, and therefore the Aruch Chaim's picture of this, the way that he would direct the movie about this, is that Moshe walks in, they can try to kill him, they can try to do anything they want to him, but nobody can touch Moshe. Moshe just walks in and speaks strongly to Paro and tells him exactly what he's thinking. Now Rashi doesn't agree with this. And Rashi says this in numerous places. I will give you at least one to see. No, he doesn't say that. And that's what we're going to come back to. Rashi and Perek Vav Pasuk Yud Gimel. Here it says, "Vaydeber Hashem Moshe v'la Aaron v'yitzavim el bnei Yisrael v'el Paro Melech Mitzrayim." Here it says, "An order v'yitzavim, order Paro Melech Mitzrayim." What does Rashi understand from this? Paro Melech Mitzrayim tzivam alav l'chalok lo kavod b'divrayim zel midrashim. It says that Rashi has tradition based on midrash that when they go into Paro, speak to him with honor. Speak to him with Paro. And Rashi understands this because it says, Paro Melech Mitzrayim. Go in to Paro, king of Egypt. He's a king. You need to speak to him with a degree of honor. Rashi doesn't say this only in this place. He also says it in Perek Hei, Pasuk Gimel, and also in Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Chet. he speaks about throughout this process, Moshe and the Jews still have to have respect for Paro, which is a very strange thing. Why respect a man like this? So apparently the reason to respect a man like Paro is that at the end of the day, no matter what is he, he's still a king. Bless you. He's still a king, and the king, see, this is what's interesting, and here we'll try to take this to another level. A king is somebody who, as far as Judaism is concerned, and this is true in terms of Christianity in the Middle Ages as well, they also have the same idea, that a king does have some kind of divine right to rule. And Judaism does say, if there's a king who has the right to give life, take life, then you make a bracha when you see such a king. And the bracha that you make is that God has shared his glory with such a person. Which means going into a king is an experience where there is part of, meaning part of God's glory there for a very simple reason. I can describe it like this. Those of us who have never seen God perhaps have a little bit of a difficulty really working on our Yirat Shamayim. And the Gemara tells us, you know, Halavai had our Yirat Shemayim be like our Yirat Basar Vidam. But when you walk into somebody who's like a king, somebody who has this incredible, incredible power, so then the feeling that one has in front of that king, perhaps then in their mind can begin to understand what it's like to stand in front of God, even though one would have to then add in Lahavdil, how many, you know, times of Havdalot. Because there obviously is going to be a difference, but walking into a king is going to be something which is somewhat of a different experience. Now again, it's interesting to me that when we see Moshe going in front of the Nile, there is one way of acting. By the way, Moshe doesn't really speak, that it is Aaron who's doing the things. But when he comes in, it's Moshe. And now the question really comes, and I'm sorry for referring to this again, but what exactly is the relationship between Moshe and Paro? This is the one thing that the Prince of Egypt did very well. They grew up together. They grew up together. Which means, could it be that Moshe privately in the palace can speak to this Paro very differently? Correct. And this palace that Moshe grew up, which is Moshe's walking into this palace. How much of this is related to the fact that Moshe is somewhat at home in this palace? When Moshe does walk inside and speaks to Paro, is it true that everyone else is really there and listening and there's this whole big scene? Or does Moshe speak to him perhaps in another way or another language? God does say, speak to him with honor. Give him, again, and speak to him with honor. Give him the respect which he deserves. This is the reason that the photocopying machine didn't work today. So I was going to give you something to read that now you can't, now you won't have. I guess it wasn't meant for you to have it. Yeah? So that I can't answer you, but the Nile is the manifestation of this divinity. And that's where of what the claim of divinity is. The Nile is what he created. So the Nile is where the, if you'll ask me, okay, where's the church? Is the church in the palace or is the church by the Nile? The Nile is the place that the, yeah.
You say they grew up together.
But
who was Paro? He was the uncle, his cousin, his... I mean,
and
that's his mother, his adopted mother's other child, what?
I can't answer that.
Oh.
I can't answer that, but these two apparently grew up at the same time inside the palace.
Just that age?
Apparently, more or less.
How much does the Russian be affected?
Perik Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel. I have in front of me two pages from a book which isn't published yet, so that's why you weren't supposed to get it, apparently. It's what I should be doing instead of coming and teaching here and sitting preparing this class. I'm supposed to be working on this book. It's a commentary on the Haggadah based on the teachings of Rabbi Soloveitchik. So I was going to share you some of this, but I can't, so I can read it. I can at least, no, it wasn't meant to be. I can at least read it to you. Bo Paro, go to Paro, is different from the wording used in the Torah in Vayera when God sent Moshe to confront Paro in the first plague of blood at the Nile River. Here we find the word lech, which means to go. Here, before the onset of the fourth plague of Aroh, pestilence, God said, place yourself before Paro. When the word lech is used, it means meeting Paro at the Nile. Bo means place yourself in front of him. The word bo and lech are characteristic of the message. We speak of people with two personalities. There are people always sinning and always repenting. King Herod was such a one. He murdered sages and then redecorated the Beit HaMikdash and prostrated himself before God. A man of power should not be a dual personality. They must reconcile their contradictions. If the king wants to enjoy many good years on the throne, he must reside among the people. To be authoritarian does not mean to lack compassion. That was all parenthetical. Moshe was told to approach Paro as the emperor, but also to approach him as another Paro, as a private person. When he approaches Paro as the king, he met him at the Nile, the symbol of the power of Egypt. Address yourself to the power-oriented Paro at the source of the power of the Nile. Stop him, block him. Tell him there are forces that are stronger. Place yourself strongly in front of him and protest. Then we find the word Bo used. Go into the king in the palace, where he's an ordinary man, a father, a husband. Tell him how wrong it is to throw a child into the water. Tell about Avraham. Tell about morality. Perhaps he will respond. Which means that warm tone which is used, which the Aruch HaYam says, no, it's only for Moshe. It's not supposed to go over to Paro. That was connected to the idea of Bo. That was connected to the beginning of our parsha. Rabbi Soloveitchik understands that you speak to Paro on two different levels. You speak to the public persona, and that's one level, but you also speak to the private individual. And you don't give up on the private individual, which means it could be that the public Paro has the kinds of pressures and his advisors are saying you can't give in or you should give, which it's a whole different issue. But going into the palace, he understands, as standing in front of Paro, as one-to-one, man-to-man, maybe even brother-to-brother, and just that's far more interesting, and speak to him as a person. By the way, I see this as king to king, which is I also think part of it. I also see okay, one second, let me finish this up and then try to explain a little bit more.
Well, maybe that explains why Paro says yes so many times in that trip,
because
he has
there is a conflict. You know what, let me say something. When we attempt to educate, or even better, to discipline our children, our students, there's more than one way of doing it. One way is to go against what I would call their Yetzer Hara, and the other way is to try to reach out to the Yetzer Tov. To go against the Yetzer Hara is, you think you're so strong, God is stronger than you. The Nile is the source of power, God's going to turn your Nile into blood. That's one way of doing things. Second way of doing it is really reaching out to him as a person, say, Paro, this is really not a decent thing to do, and you would not want this done to yourself, and you can do much better, and how do you take a child to vote? Which means it's appealing to his sense of justice, appealing to it. This is really what Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying, there's two different approaches. I can assure you that with children, you're better off to appeal to their sense of good and their sense of decency. It's very interesting to me that it starts the other way. At first, you try to appeal to someone's sense of decency. If they will not respond, then at some point you have to say, okay, so if you're not going to respond, these are going to be the ramifications. And I say that the same thing with the same thing is with students. The same thing is in many relationships. He goes on to say as follows. There's a spark of good even in the most wicked. We use the word bow when we ask someone to come closer. Lech means go away. In this case, the word lech aparo would seem to be of no sense. The Almighty, who's ambiguous, is remote and close at all times. There's no difference. Therefore, God can be bow and lech. When God told Moshe the first time, lech aparo, the voice originated near Moshe. One can never leave the Almighty, for he walks with man. When man reaches his destination, he finds God, Bo Paro, when you come, you will find Paro and me. Or it can mean, I will go with you. Now, this starts off a whole other discussion, which I'm only going to mention very, very quickly. The Bo Paro does seem to me, and again, this is what I wanted to spend a bit more time on. The Bo Paro does absolutely indicate that God will be together there. God is basically saying, I'm there. If, as I started to say before, that when the Shekhinah is in a room, or when a person is a king, the king has a bit more, a king has a something which is like, approximates divine power. It's not the same as divine power, but it approximates it. There may be all the more reason why there will be a feeling of Shekhinah in that particular place. When God says to Moshe, Bo, he's really telling Moshe, I am going to be there with you. I am coming with you. Which actually makes Moshe's job much simpler. Let's cut through to the bottom line. Who was the one who actually did all of these matot? Which means I can say that Aaron did this, and I can say that Moshe did this, and I can say ultimately all of the makot, or makot which God is doing. That should be very clear to us. And this is something which is clearly stressed when we see the Haggadah, which says that Moshe is not even a player in all this. On the words of the Haggadah, v'loy ayyidei sarah, v'loy ayyidei shaliach, I'll try to read. Parshat Shemot introduces a brand new fundamental concept of Judaism that offers a completely new perspective on the role of man relative to creation. This concept was first revealed to Moshe in Egypt. The verse that introduces the concept is often overlooked and quickly read without appreciating the significance of the idea that it conveys in terms of its relevance to Moshe and the entire Jewish people. The words of Ata Lacha v'shalachta el Paro, and now go and I will send you to Paro. What's so special about that? It's the first time that man becomes a shaliach of God, which is a very strange thing for a man to be a shaliach of God. And if man is really a shaliach of God, then how do we say that lo yayideh shaliach? I mean, if you go back to the very beginning, when I say the very beginning, I'm referring, of course, to the first time that God speaks to Moshe. This is in Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yud. Vata lecha v'ashlachecha el paro v'otzi et ami b'nei Yisrael min Mitzrayim. V'yomer Moshe Elokim, mi anochi k'elecha el paro v'chi otzi et b'nei Yisrael min Mitzrayim. That's the pasuk he's referring to. That God tells Moshe, I'm going to send you. If I'm going to send you, you will be my shaliach. V'yomer Moshe Elokim, who am I? V'yomer, what does he say? What's God's answer? Ki ehye imach. We've discussed at various points what exactly is this oath, what exactly is the sign. You go, he goes, who am I to go? He goes, no, you go, I will be with you, and here's the sign that when you take them out, then you will serve God in this mountain.
What I was thinking is, Moshe knows he grew up in the palace, so Moshe knows that Paro is someone with whom he has familiar, intimate language. How can Moshe not get it that he's the only person that can do this job?
Because Moshe is modest, which is why he's the right person to do the job.
Still.
We want leaders who don't want to be leaders.
Okay.
We don't want the leaders who want to be leaders.
But he still doesn't understand that he's the only person who fits these qualifications, and he's the part of Bnei Yisrael on the one hand. On the other hand, he can walk right in the palace and, you know, has familiarity and, you know, the animals know him.
And his hesitancy, makes him all the more attractive. But we're getting to the key right now. We're getting to the key. What is the sign? So let's think a second. Because this will get us to the core of what this thing of Bo means. Hashem says to Moshe, I will send you b'mashliach. Moshe says, who am I to go? And what does God say? I will be there with you. Now, one second. I will be there with you. What does this mean? Bo el paro. Why bo el paro? Because God says, I'm going to be there with you. And ultimately, Chazal take this so seriously, the bo el paro, that I'll be there with you. You're not doing it. Who's doing it? God is doing this. I'll read to the very end. Yeah, I won't read that to you. The Moshe would not have been able to do this without feeling that God is with him, without feeling the Shekhinah with him in every place. It is definitely interesting, and you understood what Rav Soloveitchik said. He said that there is a different level, but God is always there. There is times that God is more revealed, that God is less revealed. When they go to the Nile, at those points, God is less revealed. When they go into the palace, at those points, God is more revealed. In the palace, one can feel God. But it's interesting now, because we follow Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought, that in the palace where God is more revealed, what then does he ask Moshe to do? To speak to Paro as a person. Because if the Shekhinah is more revealed, then you have a better chance of success of getting Paro to answer. Which means, where is it less likely that Paro is going to give in? In the place that he thinks that he's God. Because the place that he thinks that he's God, at that place, the Shekhinah is not going to be obvious. In that place, the Shekhinah is going to be in hiding, as it were. Why? Because Avodah Zarah is taking place all over, right there in front of you. So therefore, when you go down to the Nile, the source of the Egyptians' false belief system, there it's going to be Lech. Is God with him? Of course God is with him. But it's not going to be felt. On the other hand, in the palace, which is a little different, a little private, their appeal to the Tzelem Elohim of power. And by the way, when we speak of our enemies, we don't like to think of them having any Tzelem Elohim. You don't want to think of Arafat, you don't want to think of Hussein, you don't want to think of Hitler having any Tzelem Elohim whatsoever. And that's why it's such an interesting statement that he's able to say that every single person, the worst person that there is some Tzelem Elohim inside. Ultimately, it doesn't work. But it's interesting now. There's two different levels. You go against the power, you go against the Yetzer Hara, and you say, well, we have more power than your power. And then on the other hand, you try to appeal on the inside to the person as a person, and to the person as a father, and to the person as a husband, and you try to look at it on a completely different level. But what's the oath? What's the sign ultimately? The sign was that you stand on the mountain, you serve. What is one thing after the other? Because the issue over here, what Moshe didn't understand, is how is it possible for man to be a shliach of God? How could man be a shliach of God? So what's the truth? What does it come down to? When it comes down to leaving Egypt, was Moshe really a shliach? Chazal say no. That what is it that took the Jews out of Egypt? It was God's Shekhinah that took them out. Where is Moshe really going to be a shliach? By Har Sinai. Har Sinai is where Moshe is going to be a shliach. Which is, Moshe says, how can I be a shliach? Well, he says, no, here's the sign that you'll be a shliach. When it comes to Har Sinai, you're going to be the shliach. You're the one who's going to climb up Har Sinai. You're the one who's going to take the luchot and give to the people. That's proof that you'll be my shliach. But it's interesting. The proof that you're going to be the shliach, it's almost much like, am I going to take them out? What's the answer? No, I'm going to come with you. I'm going to take them out. Which means when it comes to leaving Egypt, what's the answer? God is the one who takes them out of Egypt. When it goes into the palace, the Shekhinah is there. When it goes to the Nile, then it's on a different level. So that's what we saw by some of the Mepharshim saying that no, over there it's not appropriate. Who's turning the river into diamond? Is it God or is it Moshe or Aaron? Clearly it's God. But over there the Shekhinah is not going to be manifest the same way. In the palace, there is going to be a manifestation of Shekhinah. In the palace, it's ultimately going to be God that's doing all of this. Where does Moshe's shlichut, where does Moshe's mission, where does Moshe being the emissary of God really manifest itself? So I'm saying, over here, you read this passage, you realize that God agrees. God is doing all of these things. Let's just, I hope that everything was not too disoriented today. It was, you don't know how challenging it was to do this without you having any of the things that I wanted you to see. Let's just think of it this way, just to quickly recap. We noticed in the beginning it said bo. The word bo, come. Even though, perhaps, when you don't read the Chumash properly, which many people don't, and they only focus on the first pasuk in any given parsha, so then you say, oh, look at that bo, this is different, never noticed bo before. Bo, it's not the first time, but it's not the second time. When we look at Rabbi Yehuda's vision of the Makot, we find them very, very instructive. We find three groups of three. We find the ones that take place in the morning, apparently all of the first ones of the group, taking place by the river. We find the second ones of each group, we find them taking place, bo, in the palace. Here God is inviting Moshe, come. Here the Shekhinah is with him. We find the third of each group, Paro getting punished, and getting punished on a physical level, and that's the punishment for not listening to the first two. How do we see the larger structure now? We see the first one of each group is, in a sense, Paro's source of power, which is down by the Nile, by the river. God is instructing them to go against the force, against Paro's Yetzer Hara. Stand up and say, you think you're so powerful, there's greater powers. Is God there when they're doing this? Obviously, but here it's not going to be the same type of feeling. In the palace where Moshe goes in, here Moshe speaks on a different level. Moshe gives kavod. Moshe speaks to him as a person. Moshe speaks to him, and again, I apologize for this, but Moshe speaks to him as a tzelem Elohim, and more than a tzelem Elohim, Moshe speaks to him as somebody who has divine rights as a leader to do all kinds of things, and Judaism respects leadership, but you've misused this leadership. Appeal to his sense of decency. Appeal to his sense of humanity. Appeal to his morality. Give him that chance. When Paro can't do that, and doesn't have the ability to do that, and at that point, the Shekhinah is with him. Shekhinah is with Moshe, because if you're appealing to the Tzelem Elohim, then the Shekhinah must be felt at that particular point, and that would explain this idea of the Bo El Paro in those particular instances. Ultimately, Paro is somebody who's not willing to be intimidated on the one hand, and he's not willing to answer his sense of decency on the other hand, so ultimately Paro is somebody who's going to have to be destroyed. And ultimately, Paro is somebody who will have to be removed. But the process that we now see, and hopefully the larger picture of the Makot that we now see, should provide us with much more clarity. It's not simply God saying, okay, I got 10 tricks up my sleeve. Okay, here's number one. We'll do 1 to 10, and then it's over, then it's time to go. But there is a clear process taking place. As I said, if you go back, you want to read Rav Hirsch, he tries to make things fit in very, very carefully in the way that he sees the purpose of each level. As I said, it's interesting whether ultimately it's convincing or not. You'll have to choose.
Sorry, I'm lost where the third set is.
The third set is the punishment for not listening to the first two. The third set, there's no warning for. You don't warn him by the sea. You don't warn him in the house. The third set, you're punishing him, and you're punishing his person. And that's his kinim, and that's going to be the boils, and that's going to be the darkness. It's punishment for not listening to those first two sets. So therefore, you really have three sets. One, where you're going against the Yetzer Hara, the other, where you're appealing to the Yetzer Tov, and then finally, the third, you can't listen, you get punished at each set. And then you have three sets of three, ultimately going to culminate with the final one, which will be the Makat B'Chorot, and at that point, the Jews will obviously leave. We should stop, or they're going to yell at me again for running over. Yeah.